So my head is settling into the daily schedule. I've been to bed early the last couple of nights and up early the last couple of mornings, so that's starting to work itself out. Today my body is trying to meditate. Suzuki talks about our legs doing zazen and our knees doing zazen and our back doing zazen. So all of those friendly relations of mine are trying to settle in for a nice retreat together. So the story until now, to catch everybody up. Welcome Liz, welcome Gabby. The fortune teller Asita noticed all the divas and devas of Tushita heaven dancing and shouting, and they told him they are celebrating the birth of the Bodhisattva Siddhartha, who is on his way to becoming the Buddha. And so Asita goes down to, leaves Tushita heaven and goes down to earth and sees the baby Buddha and experiences the great glow like molten gold. And is very joyful, but has a little bit of sadness because he says that he is getting old and will not live to see the fruit of Buddha's practice. That was from the Nalaka Sutta. And now I'd like to read a little bit of Acharya Abhuta Sutta, which is translated as wonderful and marvelous. In this sutta, the Buddha asks Ananda, his jikō for 40 years. To tell the crowd what Buddha has told Ananda about Buddha's birth. So he's asked Ananda to recall what Buddha told him. And as we know, Ananda, after Buddha's death, recalled all of Buddha's sutras so that they could be written down. So we might say that this version is Ananda recalling Ananda recalling Buddha. So it gets a little convoluted. So Buddha has just asked Ananda to explain fully the Tathagata's wonderful and marvelous qualities. Ananda said, I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva appeared in Tushita heaven. This I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva remained in Tushita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Buddha's own lips. For the whole of his lifespan, the Bodhisattva remained in Tushita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Buddha's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva passed away from Tushita heaven and descended into his mother's womb. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Buddha's own lips. When the Bodhisattva passed from Tushita heaven and descended into his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world with its gods, its devils, its Brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and its people, and even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy and gloom and utter darkness, where the moon and sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too this immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. And the beings born there perceived each other by that light. So other beings indeed have appeared here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned from the Blessed One's own lips, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, four young deities came to guard him at the four quarters, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva and his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned from the Blessed One's own lips, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing, from taking things that were not given, from misconduct and sensual pleasure, from false speech, from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Buddha's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no kind of affliction arose in her. She was blissful and free from bodily fatigue. She saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. Suppose a blue, yellow, red, white, and brown thread were strung through a fine gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, and a man with good sight were to take it in his hand and review it thus. This is a fine gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, though it is strung, through it is strung a blue, yellow, red, white, and brown thread. So too, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she saw the Bodhisattva with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Buddha's own lips. 7 days after the birth of the Bodhisattva, his mother died, and she ascended into Tushita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth after carrying the child in their womb for 9 or 10 months, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth after carrying him in her womb for exactly 10 months. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth seated or lying down, but not the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him standing up. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard this from the Buddha's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came from his mother's womb, first the gods received him, then human beings. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch earth. The four young gods received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O Queen, a son of great power has been born to you." This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, two jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisattva and his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Buddha's. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. As soon as the Bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took seven steps north, and with a white parasol held over him, he surveyed each quarter and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. "I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am the foremost in the world. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being for me." This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. Then once again the light shines, even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail. There too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. So the Buddha then says that Ananda got it all right. He remembered exactly what the Blessed One had told him. And that's the end of that sutra. So what do we think of this? What do we think of this in 25 centuries later, sitting here at 113 School Street with our knees aching a little bit? You know, the Buddha didn't say, "Your knees are going to ache a little bit." Do we think this is how it all came about? Please.
Yeah, I mean, who's really to say it's historically accurate, but I do like the fact that it sort of speaks to our sense of wonder or awe or marvel at something that might have happened, who knows? But if you would have led with "your knees are going to be sore," you know, maybe would have just discarded the text altogether, not picked it up. So I appreciate the fact that it inspires, mm-hmm. you know, by speaking to that within us that has a reverence for the divine or whatever you want to describe that as.
So in this story of a birth, of an auspicious person that certainly affected all of our lives for 25 centuries, you're saying that the kind of baroqueness of the story was meant to inspire, was kind of a teaching tool all above and beyond the Buddha's lesson to follow our breath and to be aware of our body.
In a way, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like a marketing gimmick. by using a phantasmagorical description of anything, you know, you could sell a bottle of Coke or a set of steak knives or whatever. But, I mean, it does capture my attention. I want to read on, you know, and maybe that's, you know, a way of attracting people to a method of understanding. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Joseph.
I get the sense that the words are so grandiose, so exuberant and over the top, that the words become useless pointing to what the words are pointing to. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So they're so beautiful and floral and everything you could possibly do, but they're still just words. That's the sense that I get from that.
And why would they be that way? Yeah, they don't ring so true now, but they certainly color up our mind. Nanette, then Liz.
Although I have had other times when I read this kind, you know, when I receive this kind of language, like in the Lotus Sutra, where I don't feel that way, maybe I just didn't get enough sleep. But for the most part, I do feel irritated, like, this does not help me. And the other thing that brings up irritation in me, and I'm not sure why I have such a strong reaction, is whenever there's language that's the Blessed One saying, this is it, I'm the best, you know, there's a lot of language like that, and I can't remember, in many places in the sutras that say, I'm at the top, in a way. So I had an image just now that was really sweet and helpful to me, although probably completely beside the point, but I'm going to share it. When, and so a couple of you used the word exuberant, with this image of the Buddha taking seven steps and going svaha, you know, going, I, you know, whatever exuberant words he said to celebrate his coming into the world, I just could totally see my little two-year-old granddaughter, who many of you know, Dishane, going, ta-da! You know? And somehow I thought, I just tapped into that quality of complete, unabashed celebration, you know, and you could say of oneself, and who knows what the self-concept of a baby, you know, and a small person is, but they do have this quality that's without filters and without self-judgment and without comparing, of being able to completely celebrate, you know, a moment of their existence that's really something that most of us as adults could use a good dose of. So, it's really interesting, the question. And so what do we make of this now, and how do we receive it in such a way that has to be uplifted by it rather than irritated, like.
Did your irritation motivate you to seek some sort of resolution to the irritation?
I feel not seeking a resolution, but of course, it could be helpful. We'll see.
but just to make a quick comment, so it might be the sutras might be asking us to read them or study them with a different mind than we usually use. We can remember that, you know, Dejanay's mind. We know it's in there, and that we've got, and we're glad, you know, 60 years later, that there's other things in our mind as well. But there might be, you know, still part of our mind that can take that all in, you know, as you said, without the filters that we've now got, and really connect with it. And when you are actually with your granddaughter, you get excited about that mind, but not so much when it goes directly from here to there.
But I want to say one more thing that I think perhaps in the conversation help, but somehow it's like Disney mind. So I need to make a little bit of a distinction there.
Well, what do you mean by Disney mind? Because when Walt Disney Land, I think, opened before Walt Disney World, when that park first opened, I mean, that was it. That was before internet. That was like Mecca for a lot of people to travel far distances to visit this, you know, this fantastical land. You know what I mean? I feel like
to suspend reality.
Yeah, right? And like 2,500 years ago, I mean, I think magic in the form of stimulating someone's imagination had full sway. You had a captive audience. If you had a story like that, geez, you know?
Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, I think what's most interesting is the effect that it has on us. And I can listen to something like this better in sitting than counting by the bedside and trying to read it at another time. There is a conflict when you hear those words, I alone and the Holy One, Mark. Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate your remembering that the child, that's the way our consciousness develops. I think about 25 years ago when I was living with a couple that had a 2-year-old, and it was driving me nuts that the baby was saying, "That's my sky. That's my full sky." And I related this to my mom, and she said, "Oh no, that's how children take on the world. Everything is theirs, and it's not egotistical. It's the way, you know." So it is interesting to think about that as a positive attribute of intimacy. So and fluid boundaries, but. Another kind of disjunct in the story for me is a calling to mind the rapture of a birth, which is a mind-breaking event, an opening event, and you're in it. I haven't had children yet. I was at one birth, you know, and it was clear that it was similar to death. Really just an honor to be in that space of where time is different. You're in a whole different world. And so there's this story of birth, and we're kind of going along and celebrating birth, and then the story kind of comes to a dead when there's like, there is no more birth. So it makes you kind of think, you know, what in our daily life that is the constant birth of a moment, birth of a thought, birth of an energy? Do we just kind of go along with it unconsciously, or really go into, you know, really identify with, and And then it's like, oh, actually, maybe there's some freedom in no birth, which I don't think can be digested in a mental way. It's more kind of a question. You know?
Yeah. Thank you. Mary.
I had a different reaction than that. I actually thought it was a wonderful story, and I think part of the reason was there were little pieces of truth in it. Pregnancy certainly can be 10 months, it's 40 weeks, so you can kind of be a little different. So, and certainly many women, if they deliver with a midwife, will squat to have a child, because then you have the pressure of gravity helping. So that is part of reality for me. And I did an integrative medicine fellowship with a woman named Tia Rama Lodog, who is a Native American. And what she said was that most of the really important stories that they want you to remember are passed down through stories. That if there's a lesson that they want you to learn, they tell it to you in a story because it captures us in a certain way that then we retain parts of it. You know, rather than giving you facts, if they give it to you in a story, somehow it stays in you in a different way. You remember parts of it. I mean, I'll remember parts of the story just because of the way that it's flavored in terms of its exuberance, its magnificence, its grandiosity. But I felt more gratitude for it. And there was one line in there that particularly captured my attention, which was, this is my last birth. And I remember when Jean was dying, and it's in one of our sutras, and it's, I think it's in the setting in motion, the Wheel of Dhamma Sutra. This is my last birth. And I remember thinking, you know, in Jean's death and in her dying, she touched so many people's lives. She has such a gratitude for life. And I had that thought after she died, that she reached a point where she doesn't have to come back. That, you know, the good karma that she left in the world, that could be her last, her last birth. And so that resonated with me.
Yeah. It's, you know, that whole, it kind of touches where we were yesterday about rebirth. And the process of that, or the function of that. And you saw with Jean that she had really completed a lot of important things, and maybe that was enough. And she could then die and not have to clean up, do any more cleanup.
Well, the other thing that was really interesting was at the moment of death, she went from just supplicating the fluid to having a smile on her face because she was puffy from all the stories, and she looked just like a Buddha with her puffy face. Right after she died, she had this little smile that stayed there for about 24 hours. Mm. And it was just, she looked just like a Buddha with that little puffy cheeks and little bitty smile.
Nice. Thank you. So with the story of the Native American lore, they felt perhaps that the mind that can receive those stories has a particular function. So that it stays with us and grows with us and helps us remember those aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I did see your granddaughter jumping up and down on the sidewalk the other day when I was bringing the groceries in. Her mom had just pulled on for her dad, and she knew she couldn't run across the street to greet them, so she just was like a jelly bean, just pouncing with just exuberance that her parents had arrived.
Yes. Any other thoughts? Gabby.
I thought it was interesting stylistically. I mean, I thought it was interesting that the story kept being repeated and that there was this, and maybe So a stylistic echo of this idea of Buddha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is very enlightening creatively to think about. And but then it was interesting because the other aspect that comes in, or one of the images that I stuck with, so this metaphor of the thread and the liquid.
Liquid jewel or something. That was hard to.
It's very vivid visually, but also thread is so tied to a human experience, right? This is something that we fabricate, that we make and use for functional things. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, to me, it's very interesting that we have this exuberance of a bird that is holy, right? And
mm-hmm.
in some ways very elevated, and yet there are certain things that were bringing it back to earth in a very subtle, almost really secret way, because the thread envisioning it, I guess, as a metaphor of his fabrication, of his creation, ties in something very mundane, something very not mundane.
Yeah, it was a special power that arose, and yet the mundane part is birth in general. Is that what you were referring to as the mundane part?
Mundane was the metaphor, the thread.
Oh, the thread. Yeah.
Birth as being both mundane and non-mundane.
Yeah. It's common, but
it's tied to life and death, and it's in this kind of space that is an unusual space.
Thank you. Yeah, that was also a little 21st century echocardiogram that they could do. You know, there's all of its legs. It's got all of its legs. I don't know how they could tell faculties or not, but all of us are. Well, that was the
It was from the
Buddhist
lips.
When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no kind of affliction arose in her. She was blissful and free from bodily fatigue. She saw that the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. Suppose a blue, yellow, red, or brown thread were strung through a fine gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut. A man with good sight could see such a thing. So too, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. So, yeah, I think, you know, both, well, you... In your talk with the Wednesday before last, spoke about devotion, and when we're doing our chanting, for me, I can, this practice has given a great light to my life, great insight, great pleasure, great focus. I mean, for me, that's why I do devotional practices, because you know, ultimately, I'm really quite moved by this practice of sitting still. I'm moved in other ways, but when I think about this practice, I'm quite moved, and so it doesn't surprise me that's what we're asked to remember. We're asked to remember these great lights, and we're asked to those of you who are sometimes the doan and are facing out. You know, this morning the light coming in was just so wonderful. And I had to giggle to myself, you know, is this me being aware of something that happens every day? Is this, you know, am I finally aware of something mundane? Or is it just, you know, day two of Sesshin when I'm just in this kind of special situation that it seems more alive, just the light. But so I think this is that's how I read this as well. You know, we read yesterday that Tigan Layton thinks that you know, reincarnation might be possible, and so we have to ask ourselves if these things, could it be possible? And I'm still unknowing, but I can connect with the marvel and the wonder, because just sitting here, sometimes I marvel and wonder at this existence, at this existence, because that's all I really know. It's not marvelous and wonder that existence is. So that's where I think it comes from. You know, and, you know, 17 centuries after this, Dogen was saying, you know, we chant that, you know, when we sit here, the entire sky is illumined with enlightenment. You know, so 17 centuries later, or just 800 centuries ago, you know, a guy doing pretty much this practice was able to say those wonderful, wondrous and marvelous things. It is like a hammer striking emptiness. The exquisite peal permeates everywhere. You know, how do we take that in? Other than, you know, sometimes I feel pretty good about this too.
And then I realized I loved it.
Yeah, it's totally evolved.
I don't know where the softening was. Maybe the invocation of the earth, grass, walls, tiles, and pebbles, you know, that appreciation of everything is manifest.
Yeah. We're just thinking about, you know, it manifests for the sake of earth, you know, what are they saying to each other? You know, just trying to think about that. It's wondrous and marvelous.
Concrete existence, you know. So for me, the hammer striking emptiness, its exquisite feel permeating everywhere. I think about that in terms of like maybe past stuff or like memories or something. And then maybe in my dark room, I'm allowing those photographic negatives to process so that now, you know, I can interpret them in a totally different way.
Yeah. No, I'm so grateful for all the generations of teachers, from Buddha to Dogen, Koban and Suzuki and Catherine, who, you know, this stuff, what is it? It's rolling widely inside and outside of their minds. You know, it's just churning in there. And when they can say something, you know, with their particular karmic spin, so that it really hits me like that exquisite peel that finally has reached these ears, I'm just so grateful that they've all been trying so hard to get me to settle into this place and nothing but this place. So, thank you. Let me finish today with another teacher, Rainier Rilke, who, interesting, but I found this in 99 I did a practice period at Tassajara, and Reb was the Doshi of that. And some Zen student sent everybody a picture of Reb at the end of that practice period. Here it says Seattle Filmworks, April 19th, which is like 2 weeks after it ended, 1999. So I got it then, and it became a bookmarker. So, and here, I mean, I've looked at this before, but so here's the picture. And the picture and the guy right behind it is Kokyo himself.
Wow.
I was there with Liz. Liz was the work leader then. So here are the ancestors of our lives right here. But this is Rilke's poem, God Speaks to Us. God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your memory, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like flames and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. So maybe that's Rilke's memory of Tushita heaven. May the exquisite peel that rings in all of us moment after moment be accepted, be felt. May we be intimate with this exquisite peel, and may this sound reverberate endlessly are numberless. I vow to say them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I to them, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.